History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. For those who have family members who served in World War II, one of the common frustrations I've heard and frustrations I've read about when they try to get them to tell their stories is that many simply don't want to tell them. Maybe they're too horrific or brings back bad memories of close friends dying. But for one Marine, he was able to get many of them to divulge their stories when he put a rifle in their hands. Andrew Biggio, a young U.S. Marine, returned from combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he was full of questions about the price of war. He went looking for answers from those who had survived the costliest war of all time, World War II veterans. He's the author of the new book, The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. For 2 years, Biggio traveled across the country to interview America's last living World War II veterans. Thousands had locked away their memories forever, never sharing what they had endured with family and friends, taking their stories to the grave. So for this young Marine, getting them to talk happened when he put a 1945 M1 Garand rifle in their hands and watched their eyes light up with memories triggered by holding the standard-issue service weapon that had been with them every step of the war. It began when Biggio brought a 1945 M1 Garand rifle and handed it to his neighbor, World War II veteran Corporal Joseph Drago, unlocking memories Drago had kept unspoken for 50 years. On the spur of the moment, Biggio asked Drago to sign the rifle. Thus began this Marine's mission to find as many World War II veterans as he could, get their signatures on the rifle, and document their stories. With each visit and every story told to Biggio, the veterans signed their name to the rifle. 96 signatures now cover it. Each signature represents a person, the battles endured during the war, and the PTSD battles fought after it. So they're unfiltered, inspiring, and sometimes heartbreaking stories told by the last living World War II veterans, stories untold until now. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Andrew Biggio. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, so we'll get our sights straight, ready, aim, and do as many bad gun puns as we possibly can before we get started. So I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are gun enthusiasts, and they know about the M1 Garand. Listeners, I have heard it pronounced both ways, so this is like GIF and JIF. But for those who don't have experience with firearms, can you describe to me, what is it like to shoot one? How does it compare to today's service rifle? And what role did it play in World War II? Because that's one of the main points of your book. So can you give context to those who don't know as much about firearms?
So I've heard General Patton say that this was the weapon that won the war for the United States. That being said, because it was the first time we were actually issuing in mass production a semi-automatic rifle to our troops deploying to either Europe or the Pacific, infantry, non-infantry, whatever, the M1 Garand. What that means was you could put an eight-round clip in it and fire bang, 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 so on. Before, it used to be when they had the old three Springfield, it would be, you fired a shot, then you recocked it, fired a shot, recocked it, had to aim in, fire a shot, recocked it, had to aim in again. Here we have now superior firepower compared to our adversaries, right? So the predominant amount of German infantry and Japanese infantry, same thing. They're the same, using this bolt action type rifle. So we already now have superior firepower over the enemy. This rifle helped pave the way for many advancements of the rifle, which, basically fast forward to the M16 or the M4 or the M16A2. Where, you're now taking not an 8-round clip, you're inserting a 30-round magazine into a semi-automatic rifle. And now we also have 3-round burst for the M16s today. It really paved the way, and it did help our infantry. It was a powerful and accurate weapon. So you can have a semi-automatic weapon all day long. If it's not accurate, then it's not doing the job. So that really helped our infantry and our grunts over in World War II.
Right. And how many were produced in World War II? It was somewhere in the order of several million, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I have that or if anyone really has that exact figure. My M1 Garand that helped me on my journey was a 1945 Winchester. So it was a model Winchester.
All right. So let's get into how you first use this as a way to engage World War II vets, because something that I've encountered a lot in this series, and I've had the privilege of being able to interview a couple of World War II vets, but in speaking with authors, some of them, maybe their father served in the Korean War or World War II, a thing that they commonly say is, especially in that generation, you simply didn't talk about your war experience. And maybe it was something that they didn't talk about with anyone, or only if they were at the VFW lodge or meeting up with some of their old buddies. And then in very limited circumstances, they would talk about it. But that seems to be a common theme for men of that generation. So how did this whole process begin where you have your service rifle, you give it to them, and it seems to open the doors?
Yeah, it all started with my own grandfather's brother who was killed in World War II, Andrew Biggio, who I'm named after, who my father's named after. So I started to, when I returned home from my own service in Iraq and Afghanistan, I started to read his letters he wrote home before he was killed. And one of the first letters I'll never forget picking out of a shoebox underneath my grandmother's bed was on how much he enjoyed the M1 Grand rifle. So, of course, I immediately had to go out and buy one. The way that this kid is talking about this letter, this weapon in this letter 70 years later, it just, I wanted to connect with this long-lost relative. So I go out and I purchase this 1945 Winchester, and I'm holding it, and it just, it brought me satisfactory feelings for, I don't know, a couple hours. And then I said, well, now what? What do I do with it? So I was thinking about a gentleman who lived close by to me named Joe Drago. He was really the only World War II veteran in the area I knew of in the year 2016 or 17, was it? So I decided to bring him the rifle. And I had known Joe over the years. We ran into each other at Marine Corps events, Marine Corps birthday, Memorial Day parades, whatever. But now here I am knocking on his door and seeing how like age has caught up with him, right? So he's sitting in a recliner, his legs have atrophied into, you know, very small. He's not getting around much because of his health, because of his age, he's frail. And when I knocked on his door and he let me in, I just simply put the rifle into his hands. And it was like a burst of energy soared through his body like I had never seen my elderly neighbor before. He puts the rifle into his shoulder, he's waving it around, he's aiming in. I practically have to duck out of the way. And he just starts talking about the Battle of Okinawa for over 2.5 hours. I sat there with him with that rifle, talking about April Fool's Day, 1945, being the first wave on Okinawa Island with the Marine Corps. And so it was like, here we are, our conversation's ending after 2.5 hours, and I don't want to leave. But, you know, how can I have a piece of Joe with me forever? So I asked him to sign the rifle. I asked him to add his name to it. And he does. He signs the, you know, the stock of the rifle. And I left that house and I'm looking down at this name and I said, holy crap, I think I want to get as many names on this rifle as possible. And that's where it started.
Yeah. And I want to hear his story. I just finished a World War II Pacific series with a co-host, so I have a lot of these battles on my mind. But what do you think about it was the rifle? Is it because that was his companion, waking, eating, sleeping, that you're on an island in the Pacific or you're somewhere in France, and if there's anything that is basically an extension of your body, it's this? Do you think it's that, or do you think it's something else, or what do you think prompted that response?
The rifle was a microphone at this particular meeting. Yes, he was actually a machine gunner, a Browning machine gunner, but you know, you had to go to boot camp and train with the M1. The M1 was laying around everywhere. The guys to your left and right had them. So regardless, it is a piece of, it is like a time capsule. So the rifle acted as a microphone without a doubt. And I think also from Marine to Marine, I got him to open up a ton. He really enjoyed another young Marine visiting him. The Marine Corps is very, very different. It's different than when I meet Army World War II vets and I'm a young Marine. There's something about the Marine Corps that just really glues us as if we fought together, even though we fought 70 years apart. So, I mean, his particular story is, you know, I'm getting ready to leave the house and he says, go into my sock drawer. You know, And I'm like, okay. So I pull out this velvet Crown Royal bag, right? They used to have Crown Royal alcohol in it. And there's stuff jingling at the bottom. And he says, you know, these are yours now. And I open them up and it's Japanese gold teeth that I still have. And so he's giving me Japanese gold teeth. I'm leaving his house, and it's, you know, first of all, as like a warrior, right? I'm like, in my head, I'm like, hell yes, I have Japanese gold teeth. That was a war trophy from a Marine who fought in the damn Pacific, who forged the history of the Marine Corps forever. And at the same time, I'm thinking about, he made me feel normal. He made me feel like I don't have to hide in the shadows of the greatest generation being a younger veteran, right? Because a lot of that goes on, you know, the Iraq, Afghanistan veterans, they don't feel as good as World War II veterans, right? There's no big giant parades. There's no victory. There's no hugs and kisses in the middle of the street. There's no glorified movies and superstars. And it was really obviously, you know, the common soldier doesn't get to pick the war he goes to. So he really brought to me and educated me that even the greatest generation wasn't so great. Right. So here he is handing me gold teeth he cut out of someone's head. Here he is telling me, you know, it's a complete joke that Marines got in trouble for urinating on dead Taliban in 2010 or 11 in Afghanistan, because that's nothing compared to what we used to do to the Japanese on the island. Like people driving around with skulls strapped to the front of Jeeps, heads on pikes, skull fragments, dog tags, teeth being collected, no prisoners. Like, hello. He really finally taught me that, you know, World War II wasn't all milkshakes and swing dancing. And it was really, we were just, you know, exceptional men during an extraordinary time. We did our job and, you know, we did what we had to win the war, brute force, and it wasn't held against us. So he really made me feel that there was no difference between the soldiers today who rose their hand after 9/11 and the soldiers who raised their hand after Pearl Harbor.
Well, yeah, thanks. That's a really good point. And something I've mentioned before on the show, and listeners have heard it, that World War II, I'll always have episodes focusing on it because it created our modern world order. It's arguably the most important event that happened in modern history. At the same time, I think if people only study that, it gives them a really skewed understanding of warfare. That Hitler, I mean, there's no better villain that you could cast than that in a war, right? But there's many more shades of gray in history, and it's really not fair for somebody on the ground to be his individual valor and how much he fights for the man next to him judged through the lens of geopolitics, that somehow you're less brave because you're fighting in the Vietnam War, where you have to you're explaining to someone Soviet containment. It's hard for a 10-year-old to really understand. But they get World War II, and somehow that individual soldier is braver. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that, because that's a balance I've tried to strike as much as possible.
Yeah, and Joe really brought that to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it goes on. The book goes on with all different other individuals. Where I said, wow, you know, segregated units were treated like this? Oh, my, you know, this is the greatest generation we're talking about. They undoubtedly all together saved the world, but holy baggage, right, on what was going on behind the scenes and what's not reported on the news. You know, I interview World War II veterans who went and became police officers after the war. And I'm a police officer, so I loved that, meeting them and how they had to deal with veterans with PTSD that was thrown under the carpet, how they ignored domestic violence. Back then, there was no domestic violence laws. It was just, okay, a man's taking care of his business, let's get out of here type of deal. Officers would leave the home because a drunken veteran was smacking his wife around. You know, it's like all this stuff that was thrown under the rug that's very exploited today was really just an awakening, you know, for me. So.
Right. And when I did the World War II series, my co-host, his father was also a Marine, and he served in the Pacific Theater. And James, if you're listening to this, apologies. I can't remember if your father was on Okinawa or not. I think he was on Iwo Jima. So sorry if I forgot. But yeah, I mean, this is the end of the war, where it's sort of like the final hop before the Japanese home island, when soldiers are only getting more and more and more dug in. The resistance is more recalcitrant. It's just some of the most brutal fighting that U.S. troops may have seen, probably the Marines in history. So that makes a lot of sense that there's the psychological tension that's happening with soldiers on the ground that isn't reported in the same way that you would see in later generations in Vietnam and Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera. So tell me how your journey continues when you get the idea of seeking out other veterans and getting them to continue to sign this rifle.
So, you know, I got a little touch of the Pacific with Joe, and I looked down at the rifle and I said, well, okay, let's get someone in who fought in Europe, maybe even the Battle of the Bulge. And So it started there. Well, where do I find them? It's 2017. World War II veterans aren't walking the streets anymore. They're not even in the American Legion halls anymore. They're pretty much housebound or in nursing homes or whatever, you know, unless you meet that one freak of nature who is 100 years old, still living on his own, which I know them too. Now, you know, fast forward later. So I start looking up the Battle of the Bulge Association in Massachusetts. And this guy, John McAuliffe, is still alive at this point. And I call him. I said, hey, you know, whatever. This kid trying to sign my rifle, you know, basically more or less. So I go down to the city of Worcester, Massachusetts, and I meet John. He's living in a high-rise apartment. Basically, it's the it's public housing, projects. For a lot of people who don't know, public housing, aka projects, were developed and built for returning World War II veterans back in the 40s and the 50s. Low-income housing for veterans coming home. That's why projects were initially built. Now they have since obviously just welcome all low-income immigrants, disabled people, that kind of thing. But originally it was built for veterans. So here's 97-year-old John McAuliffe living on the 14th floor of this project building, which paint the picture, okay? Go into any project building in a city and see just a lot of moving parts, a lot of people coming and going, people of all different cultures, all different backgrounds, little kids running around. And here's, I'm knocking on the door of a World War II veteran still living on his own, the only World War II veteran in the building of 14 stories. So I meet John and I go into his apartment and he has meeting minutes, notes from Battle of the Bulge Association meetings from its opening days to their last chapter meeting in 2014, I think I want to say, because there was no one left to meet, you know. Nor could these old veterans travel and stuff, even if they lived an hour away. So he starts going through the Rolodex, telling me of men he still thinks that are alive. This guy, that guy. I'm taking photos. I'm writing phone numbers down. I'm doing everything. He's giving me all these great leads. And I spend time with them, and I'm drinking beer with him in his little apartment, and he signs my rifle. He served with the 87th Infantry Division over in Europe during the Battle of the Bulge. And I'm leaving his house, and he never had any kids. He outlived his wife, of course, at this age, like most of them. And I'm leaving his house, and he gives me his uniform, which is behind me, and he gives me a Nazi dagger. And he says, I don't know who else would be interested in this stuff. You might as well take it. It's like the guy was waiting his whole life for me to come to his apartment building in the last. And I'm saying to myself, first I'm saying, no, I'm not. I didn't come here to take advantage of you. Please, like. But he was adamant that he had no one else to give this stuff to. So, of course, I took it. And it's on display here in my little museum. But it's these memories are just unmatched. They're just unmatched. And leaving his house, I left with the names of at least 10 other veterans to go meet and share their stories. One who actually formed a chapter in my book, Ernie Roberts, Silver Star recipient, machine gunner from the 87th Division. So this is just, you know, another way on how the localness of the rifle started. Once I started getting these names locally and their stories locally, well, then it was like, oh, wow. An adjacent unit to the 87th Division was the 761st Tank Battalion, an all-black tank unit. Wow. I wonder if there's any survivors left. Well, guess what? I found one in Bucks, Alabama. So now I got to go to Bucks, Alabama, middle of nowhere, to meet a gentleman. And I went to every corner of the country to meet men from specific divisions, from specific units, particular battles, because in the year from 2017 to 2021, I'm chasing ghosts now. Very difficult to do World War II research. Very, very difficult. I wasn't just opening a book and reading it and retyping something. I wanted to go to the source. I wanted to meet the veteran. And then boom, oh, you haven't been back to Belgium yet? You haven't been back to Paris yet? Yeah, France yet? Next thing you know, I'm on a plane going back overseas with them. So I can see the houses they're talking about, the foxholes they were in. A lot of people asking, hey, you going to write about Korea next? I said, this one almost killed me. I can't, you know, I can't chase ghosts again, you know, so.
So what was the process like? You begin with one veteran, and then that starts this process where he knows these different people. He opens up his Rolodex. You have the contact information for someone else. What's the initial outreach like? I guess you call them up, and then was there a common pattern to their first meetings and how they reacted when you gave them the rifle, they held it? What was that process look like in general?
Common response basically was, I'm lonely, I'm 98 years old, come over. Come over to the house, please. Then you had the small percentage of who the hell are you? Very, very small. You're not bringing a rifle to my house. I didn't take no for an answer. I sat down, I hand wrote them a letter the way they always communicated their whole life, being at their age, with photos of all the different men signing my rifle, who I am. Next thing you know, they call me back up. This is amazing. Yes, I'd love to take part in it. I think of the 200 veterans on the rifle, it was one who really denied me of 200. And he was dealing with all sorts of issues. He had all sorts of cancer. He was living in filth and squalor in his house, didn't want any visitors, and he ended up dying not shortly after that letter he sent me. But I tried everything I could to try to meet him. But he was a 82nd Airborne veteran of, I think, the 504th Parachute Infantry, I think. So he was just adamant again. But anyway, so go for, so that would have been the 201st signature if I had gotten that guy. But 200 men and women agreed to meet with me and hold the rifle and sign it. So that was the common response. They get it in their hands and they lit up like the 4th of July. Like, they're kids again. I have video after video, photo after photo of them smiling ear to ear. Some of them who invited their whole families over there into their living room to watch dad hold this rifle again, or grandpa hold this rifle. And yep, this is, you know, just the same two things. Wow, I don't remember it being this heavy. And yep, this is what I had as this staring at it.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. What I imagine, and usually my imagination isn't correct, but picking them up and they quickly sight it, and it's not bolt action, but if it were a bolt action rifle, quickly doing that and, you know, moving fluidly as if they were in their 20s.
Those who had the energy, the strength, lifted it up to their shoulder. Other people were, you know, guys were like, whoa, you know, it was almost tipping them over at their age. So
I'd love to hear some of the stories that you've heard, and something I think about with histories that have been written about World War II. Sometimes it's easy to think that, well, there's really nothing new because we've had biographies and autobiographies for decades, and, you know, their experiences are frozen in amber. Nothing can change. But what's interesting is that there are certain things that have come out only in recent decades. And I'll give an example in a very different context. When I was doing the World War II Pacific, my co-host and I did an episode on kamikazes. And it turns out that from about the 1990s onward, veterans in Japan would open up about their experiences. And there are actually a number of surviving kamikazes. Some of them were disillusioned and they turned around and landed and claimed that they had a plane malfunction. Others simply ran out of gas and landed anyway. Many of them felt shame or survivor's guilt, so they simply never talked about why they didn't participate. But only in recent decades, when the national attitude changed so much in Japan, it was possible for them to be more candid about what happened. Now, of course, this is a very different situation describing about World War II vets in America, but did you get anything like that when you were talking with different people who were maybe able to assess things in a different way than they could in the 50s or 60s?
Yeah, that's a two-pronged question for me, because stolen valor is very real, even for men in their 90s. Some of them have been telling the same lies for 75 years, because in World War II, there were 16 million World War II veterans at one time. 16 million. Who didn't want to be the guy who didn't see combat or didn't do something heroic or whatever? So a lot of them basically would embellish their stories and what they did and who they were. And I found that a few different times, guys saying that they were, you know, B-17 ball turret gunners. And I find out they were just mechanics in England and had never left England. Guys who were said, you know, they'd fought in the Battle of Bulge and were shot, and I get their records and they were in the army band and played the tuba. You know, all sorts of stuff like that. And then the second part of it is, I think they opened up. So here's the second part of it. The World War II generation is also the silent generation. You always hear people say, Grandpa never talked about it. Dad never told me anything about the war. I have no idea what division my great-grandfather was in. B-17 because they didn't a lot. And then the other half of this, that a lot of guys didn't talk about because they didn't feel like they were special. There were 16 million World War II veterans. Whoop-de-doo. Everybody went to the war. You were no different than the next guy. So a lot of guys didn't just talk and share their story. And plus, it was traumatic what they went through. So here I am, 75 years later, as a young veteran pleading with them, saying, listen, our younger generation of veterans are coming home today and need to know how to live a successful life after war. You did it. You're 97 years old. You had a career, a life, a family, a job. Tell me what you went through. Let's inspire some of these younger veterans who went through trauma and chaos and didn't get to. And then I almost guilt them into talking about finally what they did. And I know that because when I'm leaving the house or the kids grab me and say, I never heard my father say that. I never heard grandpa say anything like that. You really had him open up. We'll never forget what this was, what this did. And a lot of things is like, I don't think these guys want to die with their secrets anymore. Now they know they're in the last stages of their lives. They haven't talked about it. I know it hurts, but don't be selfish kind of thing. Because a lot of younger veterans are looking at you as an inspiration. So there were several, my book is filled with stories that have never been told before and some that have been told a million times, but I tell it my way because it's my message to the younger veterans on how they can also enjoy life after war.
And I want to come back to that because that is kind of a grand historical question of channeling veterans into effective members of society, because I mean, some societies have done spectacularly well with it and created a wonderful civic culture, and then others have done it very poorly. And that's where you get huge bandit networks, because you take men, teach them how to fight, and then give them no opportunities when it's all done and your economy stinks and, you know, things get bad. But before getting back to that, I'd love to hear, are there particular stories that stood out to you as you're talking with all of these veterans?
Yeah, there's 200 veterans in the rifle, and I chose, I think, about 19 of them to make the book. Since the book went into print, I could do a second version if I want to, because of how many guys I met afterwards that were just unbelievable, unbelievable stories that I didn't meet soon enough. I'm going to talk about, you know, because you were talking about the Pacific. I'll stay on the Pacific. But Bernie Ruchin was 2nd Marine Division, 2-2, if I'm not mistaken, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marines on Saipan and Tinian. He survived the biggest bonsai charge of the war, what's documented. It's something around 2,000 Japanese with their backs to the ocean in Saipan rushed the Army and Marine Corps lines with swords, sticks, little ammo, the whole thing, spears. So he went on to become a New York State trooper after the war. So he's involved in some of the worst fighting on Saipan. He's wounded by a grenade, I believe near Garapan. And then survives the largest bonsai charge only because he results to hand-to-hand combat where he then takes a Japanese soldier's life with a bayonet in the neck. And while he's stabbing one Japanese soldier, another Japanese soldier's raising his hands over his head and coming down with the sword on Bernie's head. But luckily the helmet made the blade slip off, and the BAR gunner is able to reload and help kill that other Japanese soldier. So here's a man who kills another man with a blade, not shooting him from far away, has to come home, put on the New York State Police uniform, and live this normal life as an example, as an enforcer, and as a level-headed bipartisan police officer. And when I talk to him, and he's, you know, in the 50s. Oh, by the way, he does go to Korea. He gets reactivated for Korea and gets wounded in Korea too, and then sent back home, put in a New York State Police uniform. All right, this guy, like, wow. He ends up leaving the Marine Corps as a gunnery sergeant, wounded in Saipan, wounded in Korea, seen the worst of the worst, the two of Marine Corps' worst battles. And he's back home. It's the late 50s, 60s, and he gets a call for a man running around the town square somewhere in New York with a machete. And they get there, and him and his partner see the guy, and he's completely crazed. And they say, you know, a bystander says, "Listen, you know, be careful. You know, just he was in the Battle of the Bulge. He's not right in the head." And Bernie looks at his partner. They're both veterans of the Pacific, and they said, "Okay, let's not try to kill this veteran." So they're able to distract the man. They tackle him. They, you know, get the machete away from him. And Bernie looked at me and he said, "That's when I learned that everyone has a different perpetuation for weakness on how much the mind can take." Now, this is really old school talk and calling somebody weak or whatever. This is really old school stuff. But he was just saying that a lot of people have how much their mental mind can take before they can crack, depending on, you know, basically biologically how they're made up. It's the brain is no different than any other type of muscle. And there have been times where he's wanted to also crack up. And he said that he worked alongside with other police officers who were World War II veterans who were just as crazy, you know? And he was able to take a step back and say, you know, I'm a survivor, not a victim, right? So I was part of the Marine Corps. I was part of the greatest fighting force in the world. I can use that as a hunch and be a victim for the rest of my life, or I can be a survivor. This is a gentleman who doesn't drink. He's just a very notable guy, honorable guy, who uses his Marine Corps history as an example for younger Marines all over. And when I saw him, you know, now he's retired, living in New Hampshire, and he's able to basically live this great life. You know, he really taught me that, and he's teaching a lot of other Marines that they can also be Bernie Rutjen, right? But he taught me, you know, that this, and I'm going back to what was really covered up during World War II, was the combat fatigue, aka shell shock, aka post-traumatic stress disorder. The government and the country itself didn't want to admit that our boys were coming home with issues. It was hidden. Some of them became bank robbers. Some of them became committed suicide. Some of them drank at the local VFWs, the local water holes, and came home and beat their whole families. You know, this was the side of World War II veterans that I never saw, because thanks to Bernie. And the way that Bernie was able to channel himself, being one of the most guys who've seen the most severe combat, into having this quasi-normal life, I believe was one of the greatest inspirations of all. So yeah, that answers the question.
Well, I really appreciate that, because this provides a lot of nuance that sometimes with World War II, with the opening credits for Band of Brothers, where everything is sepia toned and everyone is heroic. I mean, I'm not denigrating. I mean, there's incredible stories of heroism. You talk to a Medal of Honor recipient in your book. But it's not as if there was something in the water in the 1940s that made everybody brave, and then that somehow went away.
No, I have so many stories in my book of retreat, mutiny. I just remember a lot of guys saying, like, I didn't see any of the stuff in the movies. I didn't see any of it. I saw a lot of scared kids, I saw a lot of war crimes, executions. Everyone was scared. And Bernie's account on Saipan, I mean, there was just body on top of body on top of body on top of body. That's how the hand-to-hand fighting was. Guys were dying on top of each other. You know, the artillery doing point-blank firing missions because the Japanese are running at them in waves. The Japanese taking over other howitzers, and other howitzers having to shoot their American howitzers because they've been overtaken by Japanese. Howitzers having point-blank duels. I mean, this was just a crazy, crazy battle in Saipan, you know. And Bernie was able to come home and really still grab life by the horns and not let his traumatic experience break him down. I keep that him in mind whenever I have stresses. So
I'd love to hear about lessons you learned from these vets, and this ties into that bigger question I was alluding to earlier of how a society successfully treats its veterans and how it processes a thing like a war. Because we have examples of Greek city-states that celebrate martial culture. Sparta is an extreme example, but there's an idea that to participate in society in a certain way, you have to serve, because in a way you have skin in the game of your society. It would channel veterans into different positions in politics or military command so that there's successful integration of them. And it arguably created the robust civic life that Western civilization has studied for centuries as how you build a society and how you incorporate the military into it in a good way. On the other side of it, I study the Ottoman Empire, and sometimes it was successful. When it was unsuccessful, it would fight a war and then it would just release soldiers back into their communities, not really give them any kind of material support to transition into civilian life. And as I alluded to earlier, there would be huge bandit networks that would form because they knew how to fight. Maybe there was a famine, they had no money, so this is the only way they could really raise any types of sustenance. So that's a failure of it. And with America itself, there's different ways that we've processed our wars. We've mentioned that in some ways there's World War II is exalted and you've seen the shades of gray in it. But then there are things like the Vietnam War, where with movie makers like Oliver Stone, it's sort of like everyone is a baby killer. And it's there's been a bit of a pushback against that, where I've had a few book authors on who talk about different rescue missions and other things that happened in Vietnam. And so there's complexity in every civilization. So what did you learn talking with these vets? And because a lot of what your book is not just their fighting experiences, but what happens afterwards, and you want to hear their stories so they can help modern day vets take the next step with their lives. What do you think about how society should deal with veterans, and what's good and what's bad, and what do you make of it all?
Yeah, you know, you brought up an interesting point. Yeah, Oliver Stone was a Vietnam veteran, so I don't know why he want to paint his own generation of veterans as weed smoking, dope using, baby killing, raping, war crime thing. Because I meet a lot of Vietnam veterans who served honorably and fought honorably. So I don't know if he was letting his movie brain get in the way on how to get more ratings and more views and things like that. But that's a shame, because yes, as a young kid seeing Platoon for the first time, it didn't make me honor Vietnam veterans the way I do World War II. Okay, that's what you do. When you get the silver screen, you have America right there. The movies and the silver screen bring more awareness and education to the general public than a book does. Okay. People, as many people as before, aren't picking up books anymore. Now that you have Netflix, YouTube, HBO, go on Hulu, Amazon Prime. So that's your chance to really put veterans on a pedestal, to amplify their sacrifice and educate the youth. That's why I pray my book goes to TV and movies. But what I did with my book is what I tried to show all of that. I wanted to show the bravery. I wanted to show that they're human. And I wanted to obviously show the factual racial divide in America in the 1940s and how far we've come. Black Americans being segregated, having a handbook. Military police were issued how to deal with the Negro soldier. That is a pamphlet that they were given. You know, this is the stuff that that really gets not talked about a lot. Japanese Americans in the same units only being allowed to really fight in Italy, so they don't go in the Pacific. And at first were called illegal aliens and weren't even allowed to join. So these are the things that I want to educate the youth. But the whole point of that is not, it's not a feel bad for me story. It's to show you, look what they overcame. They had an enemy at home with racism and an enemy abroad that was trying to kill them. But yet they helped win World War II, liberate other countries, and then go on and not feel sorry for themselves after war and continue, like I always, you know, I keep being repetitive about living that successful life, not peaking at military service, but keep going on and on, having 8 kids, having a career, retiring, a beautiful home, being an example, still going to church on Sundays in their 90s, taking care of their wives until their dying days. So that's what my purpose I want to show is that, you know, we can still have that baggage, right, of that poor history of the way we treated specific soldiers or specific backgrounds or racially, but the fact that we overcame it, we became one, then we got rid of a segregated military, everybody joined forces. And you know what? These Tuskegee Airmen, these black tankers, these Japanese Americans, they still stand up and salute the national anthem and love the flag, even after the crap they went through. So it's when a lot of people like today want to take out the country's frustrations on the stars and stripes and on the American flag, the flag's also a representative of how far we've come and what we've overcome. And it's also a symbol of hope. So, you know, I want to show all of that. That's what I try to aim. I'm not trying to hide anything. And I'm not trying to overkill that soldiers in World War II were bad and we carpet bombed Germany and we did this. And, you know, unfortunately, it took brute force to win the war. And it's a brute force we don't use anymore. And that's why we get stuck in quagmires of wars like Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, because we don't do it the way we used to do it in World War II, which was you took land. When you took land, you owned it. There were a front lines. If you thought the enemy was in a town, well, then you sent 300 B-17s over the sky and you leveled the town before you sent troops in it. We don't do that stuff anymore. So it just brings a little bit of reality and a little taste of everything together. That should give the common World War II soldier or the World War II history I'm talking about just a level of respect. That's all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've done a lot with this book. I mean, these are some large historical themes we discussed, but it's filtered through experiences of individuals, which I think always makes it easier to digest this, and provided some great examples here of how people have processed their war experience. So the name of the book is The Rifle. Where can people go to buy it and also support your other work online?
Yeah, please buy The Rifle on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble. The Rifle, you'll find it. I'm sold out on Amazon right now, which is frustrating, but in about 4 or 5 days, the second edition will be replenished on there. So Instagram is @therifle_. And I'm not done. As long as these World War II veterans are still breathing, I'm still going to be sharing their story.
All right. Well, really appreciate it, Andrew, and best of luck on all that.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at 3 levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.